Chapter 13, The New Testament. The Old Testament was designed to unite the Jewish race and give them a binding creed. Its objective was to give the race a united solidarity, such as none has ever achieved before or after, and to give them purpose, direction, and a program to conquer and plunder the rest of the world. Early in their history, the Jews realized an astounding fact of human nature. They discovered what an amazingly powerful weapon was religion, defensively and offensively, constructively and destructively. They have capitalized upon this discovery to the ultimate throughout their long and tortuous history. By skillful use and manipulation of religions, they have not only survived, but prospered. They have built a solidarity of race no other people has accomplished. They have demolished all enemies, and all other peoples are their enemies, though these enemies might be 100 times more powerful than themselves. This they have done through the fantastically skillful use of religion. It is high time that we, the white race, too, grasp this powerful weapon into our own hands for our own benefit. Whereas Judaism was designed to unite the Jews into a solid ramrod, Christianity, on the other hand, also a Jewish creation, was designed to do just the opposite to their enemies, divide, confuse, and destroy them. The New Testament was also written by the Jews. It supposedly revolves around the character of Jesus Christ, who is identified in the very first chapter of the New Testament, Matthew 1, as being the direct descendant of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, through David and through Joseph and Mary, with great emphasis being placed upon him being a purebred Jew. In Luke 2:21, it reads Jesus was a circumcised Jew. Christianity designed not for the Jews, but was designed to destroy the great white power of the times, in particular the Romans, and in general the white race. It was designed not to unite and solidify as the Old Testament had done for the Jews, but designed to divide, confuse, and destroy the white race. We therefore list the New Testament as a second book of major importance, undoubtedly of the greatest importance produced by the Jews in their program to destroy the white race. Not only was Christ himself a circumcised Jew, but so were Matthew, Mark, John, Peter, and all the rest of the so-called apostles, with the probable exception of Luke. Nevertheless, Luke ran around with Paul, who was a Jew, and who purportedly wrote practically half of the New Testament, and was, therefore, under his complete influence. So regardless of what angle we approach it from, the New Testament was written by the Jews, and it is a Jewish production. The adherents of Christianity are continuously being told over and over again, thousands of times, that the New Testament and its prime spokesman, Jesus Christ, brought glad tidings to the world. We hear so much about it bringing peace on earth, goodwill to men. This, the spokesman of Christianity, known as preachers, pastors, ministers, reverends, priests, etc., keep repeating over and over again. It is embedded in a multitude of hymns and songs and sermons and speeches and slogans until their adherents are so mesmerized by the idea they take it for granted. The trouble with most people who profess to be Christians is that they have never taken the trouble to really read the New Testament, to which they claim to be so dedicated. Those who have read smatterings of it have not put the pieces together and understood what it is all about. While they are devoutly meandering and laboring through a labyrinth of impossible contradictions and meaningless generalities, they never suspect that the whole purpose of the book is to confuse, divide, and demoralize the white race. However, it shouldn't be so hard to understand Luke 12:51-53, where Christ purportedly says, "Suppose ye that I am come to give peace on earth. I tell you, nay, but rather division. For from henceforth there shall be 5 in one house divided, 3 against 2, and 2 against 3. The father shall be divided against the son, and the son against the father, the mother against the daughter, and the daughter against the mother-in-law against her daughter-in-law, and the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law." Does that sound like peace on earth and goodwill to men? If you ask your preacher to explain that, he will give you about an hour's worth of double talk, and when you come out of there, he will have so browbeaten you that you think, well, he probably has the answer, although you don't understand it. The fact is, he doesn't have any answer. The fact is that this passage states the intent and purpose of the New Testament more clearly than any other quotation. We must remember that the New Testament is the basis of Christianity, and Christianity has only flourished among the peoples of the white race. It was, of course, rejected by the Jews, and 2,000 years later, it is still rejected by the Jews. This despite the fact that Christ and his disciples were a completely Jewish group, we are told by the New Testament. Just how does the New Testament go about accomplishing this divisiveness and this breaking up of the family, of the individual, of the nation, and of the white race itself? This is most clearly spelt out in the Sermon on the Mount, which anyone can read in chapters 5, 6 and 7 of Matthew. Most of the suicidal advice and teaching that is given to the white people is contained in those brief chapters, but not all of it. More of the disintegrating advice and philosophy that brought down the Roman Empire is sprinkled throughout the rest of the chapters of Matthew, Mark, Luke and John. And much of the so-called new teaching is repeated over and over again throughout the entirety of the New Testament, but particularly the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. These 4 Gospels are regarded by the Church as being the cornerstones of the Christian creed. But before we go into the suicidal teachings embodied in the Sermon on the Mount, I want to once and for all refute the lying claim that Christianity brought glad tidings or glad news. It is, on the contrary, a teaching and philosophy of gloom and doom. Undoubtedly, the most terrible indictment that can be brought against Christianity is that it has introduced into the minds of millions and perhaps billions of people, from their earliest tender childhood, the most vicious and hideous concept that was ever invented by the depraved mind of man. I am speaking about the very idea of hell. Only by dredging up from the very lowest depths of a perverted collective Jewish mind could such a heinous concept originate. Can you think of a more hideous, depraved and hateful idea than that of sending people into confinement, setting fire to them and having them burn forever and ever in all eternity without even allowing the mercy of death? I would certainly never want my grandchildren to have their minds polluted with such an abominable and terrible idea. Nowhere else in human history has a more despicable and atrocious concept ever been dreamed up and promoted as the idea of hell in the so-called new teachings of Christ that was supposedly bringing peace and love to a waiting world. If ever a depraved, sadistic human perpetually practiced this kind of torture on animals, i.e. slowly torturing them by burning them in a cage, but keeping them alive as long as possible, what would you think? The outrage that would ensue would cause such a person to be strung up from the nearest lamppost. Yet how much worse is hell? To pursue such vindictive torture into all eternity by the Lord himself, on the very creatures he designed and created. How hideous, how depraved. And this is the kind, loving God we should worship? Only the tormented, twisted mind of a Jew could dream up such a ghoulish monstrosity. And to think the white Gentiles were stupid enough to fall for such depravity and teach it to their children. We think about how abominable the savages are in their warfare in torturing their prisoners. We think of the Indians' depravity of scalping their prisoners and perhaps torturing them for a day or two before killing them. Vicious and uncivilized as this may be, it is a thousand times more kind and merciful than casting them into hell, a superheated confined torture chamber, the millions and millions of poor souls that are supposedly earmarked for this everlasting torture. And who prepared this cozy bit of red-hot coals into the fire that never shall be quenched? Where the worm dieth not, and the fire is not quenched? Why, our good, gracious, kind, and loving God. That's who, of course. And for what reasons would our good, kind, loving God heap such vengeance upon us? Why, the reasons for him doing that are almost endless. Perhaps you didn't eat the right apple. It was a forbidden fruit, but you weren't too clear on that. Or maybe in your thinking you're honest, and you came to conclusions that weren't exactly like those you were supposed to think and believe. So therefore you would be relegated to the eternal hellfire. Or perhaps somebody was thirsty, and you didn't bring them a glass of water just at the right time. So that would entitle you to an eternal damnation. Or perhaps you were a devoted follower of Mohammed, and hadn't heard too much about Christ. So you believed in Mohammed. That too would reap upon you the vengeance of the Lord. Or perhaps sometime in a moment of distraction, you blasphemed the Holy Ghost. That being a cardinal sin, and is never forgiven, would surely land you in the eternal hot coals. In any case, there are thousands of reasons why you should be tortured forever and ever, in a hot fire that is never quenched, and there are almost no means of escaping it. That is what the good book says. So what are the glad tidings and the good news that Christianity brought to the world? They are not good news at all. They are the harbingers of doom. The supposedly good news is that there is an everlasting hell to which you will almost surely be relegated. And even should you escape it, undoubtedly, by the law of averages and by the law of percentages, most of your relatives, your brothers, your sisters, your children, your parents, most of them would most surely end up in hell. Those are the glad tidings that Christianity brought to the world. I can't think of anything more gloomy and more depressing than such a message. Of course, the good news message is supposed to be now that you know there is a hell and that you're almost surely going to it. Christ came along to intercede with his Father, who, being rather vengeful, demanded a blood sacrifice, that his Son be nailed on the cross, and his blood flow from his sides. And this was to atone for your sins. Of course, until you were told that you were a no-good, low-down, dirty sinner, committing sins all the time, you didn't know that you were a sinner. So there is some more good news for you. So the whole sleazy argument of the good news that was brought to you adds up to something like this. You are brought the good news that there is a terrible place called hell waiting for you in the hereafter, that you are a dirty, low-down sinner, born in sin and will most surely go to this terrible place that is prepared for you, where the worm dieth not and the fire is not quenched, that you have to completely remake and remodel yourself from the form in which nature created you, and all the healthy instincts that nature implanted in you for your own self-preservation are all bad and all wrong. You have to be born again and believe unto the Lord, whatever that means, so that he and his grace, whatever that means, will save you from this eternal damnation. There, in a nutshell, is the good news that Christianity brought to the world, the most outstanding feature of which is fear. Fear of this horrible new monster, hell, that they suddenly filled you full of. The outstanding characteristic of this whole shabby teaching is a horrible psychological fear. It drove those who believe this trash almost insane with fear, ready to comply and do just about anything that their shepherds of the church would urge them to do. On the other side, of course, if you did completely subjugate yourself to the will of the church, then there was a reward, a nebulous place called heaven. But the description of that place was not nearly as specific or as dramatic as that of hell. In any case, with these two psychological weapons, the carrot and the stick, heaven and hell, Christianity set about to conquer the Roman Empire and dismantle it, and plunge the greatest civilization of classical history into the abyss of the Dark Ages. History shows us that these two psychological weapons did work, and Rome did fall to pieces. Of these two psychological weapons, fear, the monstrous fear of hell, was by far the most powerful. Having firmly established these two concepts of heaven and hell, and especially hell, the new teaching set about to put a high premium on belief, faith in that which you do not see. Simply put, this means believe in what we tell you to believe in, although we don't have a shred of evidence to offer. No matter how ridiculous the teaching, if you could only make people believe it, it was as good as real, lack of evidence notwithstanding. This the whole Jewish network set about to propagate amongst the Romans with a vengeance. Unfortunately, the Romans were stupid enough to buy this bag of garbage, and with it came the teachings that really tore them apart, namely, the bad, suicidal advice embodied in the Sermon on the Mount. Whereas the concepts of heaven and hell were already mentioned in the Old Testament, they were of minor importance, and certainly were not as dramatically portrayed and spotlighted as they are in the New Testament. The Jews were primarily interested in overcoming their enemies, committing genocide on all the tribes and cities that they could get their hands on, and marching forward with the blessings of their Lord, Jehovah. All this tended to unify and mold the Jewish race. With the Sermon on the Mount in the New Testament, we find an altogether different story. However, we find here that Christ is dispensing a new kind of advice, and it's the kind of advice that if you do follow it, you would most surely tear yourself apart, destroy yourself, destroy your family, and destroy your nation. And this, my dear white friend, is exactly what it was designed to do. Not to destroy the Jews, who were immune to it and were perpetrating it on the white race, but to destroy their enemies, the whole Roman civilization of that time in particular, and the white race in general thereafter. When you mention the Sermon on the Mount to the average person, he doesn't have the foggiest idea what it's all about, and thinks that it is a collection of nice, idealistic platitudes which, perhaps, are not easy to accomplish. But wouldn't it be nice if everyone did do those things? And the answer is no. It would not be nice if everyone did those things. It would destroy us, and it would also destroy our civilization and our race. The concepts contained in the Sermon on the Mount are not idealistic. They are downright stupid and in complete contradiction to all the laws of nature, in contradiction to the good, healthy, clean, natural instincts that nature imbued you with for your own self-preservation, and in general, in complete contradiction to all the sensible, good laws that civilization has built up over the thousands of years. Most of the Sermon on the Mount is contained in Matthew chapters 5, 6, and 7, but it is again repeated in other places. Additional similar ideas are sprinkled throughout the four Gospels in particular, and some of it throughout the rest of the New Testament. We are now going to examine most of the outstanding ideas incorporated in the Sermon on the Mount, and see just how wonderful, beautiful, and idealistic they really are. In so doing, we must at all times keep in mind what would happen if, for instance, one group, namely the white race, adopted these rules of playing the game, and the other side, namely the Jews, did not adopt them, but stuck with the eternal laws of nature in fighting for their own self-preservation. If we look at it from this point of view, the results are disastrous for the white race. In Matthew 5:3, Christ says, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven." And verse 5, "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth." Once the ideas of heaven and hell are thoroughly soaked into your mind as being real, then of course, everyone would want to be blessed. Therefore, if you want to be blessed, you'd want to be poor in spirit and meek. Whereas, this kind of person would ordinarily be the village idiot and the clown. He is now upgraded to where he is the future inheritor of the earth, and he's going to get the kingdom of heaven. And not only that, but above all, he is blessed. We all know what the words poor in spirit mean. They indicate that a person is dumb, stupid, and ignorant. Now the word meek is not quite so well defined in the average person's mind. So let us go to Webster's dictionary and see what it means. Webster gives three shades of meaning for the word. 1. Manifesting patience and long-suffering, enduring injury without resentment, mild. 2. Deficient in spirit and courage, submissive, tame. 3. Not violent or strong, gentle, moderate, weak. Then it also gives us the synonym, the word humble. And there you have a description of the type of person that is now desirable in the eyes of the Lord. Since we are not all born that way, i.e. stupid, ignorant, dumb, submissive, and weak, we should all, of course, try our utmost to become such village idiots, because, of course, we all want to be blessed, don't we? Of course, we must always again keep in mind that this is what the Jew is telling the white race to be. Isn't that kind of cowed, submissive person so much easier to subdue and plunder, to ravage and to enslave, than a strong, bold, intelligent, and courageous and aggressive individual who knows what his rights are and has the courage to defend his life, his property, his family, and his country? This concept of voluntarily becoming submissive is, of course, completely a contradiction and a perversion of nature's laws. Everywhere in nature it is the strong, the bold, the quick, and the intelligent that survive, whereas the weak and the slow fall by the wayside. In Matthew 5:12, Christ says, "For great is your reward in heaven," and Matthew 6:19, "Lay not up for yourselves treasures upon the earth, where moth and rust doth corrupt, and where thieves break through and steal, but lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust doth corrupt, and where thieves do not break through nor steal." The implications of this advice are, of course, catastrophic for the white race. If we again consider that the Jews would have no part in this idiotic advice, and it would only apply to the white Gentiles. You are being told that it is completely pointless to be industrious and thrifty, and be a builder, such as is instinctively characteristic of the white man. You are urged to forget about providing for your family, or planning a future, or building a business, or creating an enterprise, or any other constructive effort that you would naturally apply yourself to. If you have already made the mistake and acquired some property in the past, why? Undo this quickly and get rid of it. Of course, this is an extremely good deal for the Jew, who will be right there waiting to grab it as soon as you are ready to let it go. Whereas the Jew makes sure that he gets his in the here and now, he wants to make sure he gets yours also in the here and now, by having you keep your eye on the hereafter and meekly submit to his plunder on this earth, the only place where man has ever been known to exist, spiritually or otherwise. We notice in this case, as happens time and again throughout the Bible, the use of the non sequitur argument. Non sequitur in Latin means it does not follow. In this case, the clinching argument is supposed to be that there is no point in trying to get ahead in this world, or trying to save anything, or lay up any treasures, because here you have two obstacles presumably insurmountable. Namely, we have rust, we have thieves, and in heaven you don't have rust, and you don't have thieves. So therefore, forget about it. As far as trying to build anything, or save anything, or produce anything, or lay anything aside or plan for the future, this is, of course, a silly non sequitur argument. If the worst things in this world we had to worry about were rust and thieves, it would most certainly be easy sailing. Personally, I don't know whether I've lost much in the way of substance from rust, and so far very little from thieves. So far, therefore, I am completely unconvinced that these two obstacles are insurmountable. I am not at all convinced that I should make no effort to build, or plan, or acquire anything. Now that we have mentioned the non sequitur argument, which is used time and again throughout the Bible, we will be using that term again wherever it applies. The non sequitur argument goes something like this. It is raining, therefore it must be Tuesday. Of course, anyone knows that it does not necessarily follow that it is Tuesday because it is raining, because we know that it has also sometimes rained on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, and furthermore, there have been any number of Tuesdays that it hasn't rained. That, in essence, is the non sequitur argument, and it is used to ad nauseam throughout the Bible. In Matthew 5:25, Christ dispenses to us the choice piece of advice, "Agree with thine adversary quickly, while thou art in the way with him, lest that any time the adversary deliver thee to the judge, and the judge deliver thee to the officer, and thou be cast in prison." And in verse 40 of the same chapter, he advises us, "And if any man will sue thee at law, and take away thy coat, let him have thy cloak also." These two, in essence, say the same thing, and were a man to follow this kind of dumb advice, he would, in short order, be walked over by just about anyone that came along, especially the rapacious, plundering Jew. It says, in essence, that no matter whether you are right or wrong, don't put up any fight to protect your property. Just let anybody come along and run over you and walk away with anything you have. This is, of course, wonderful for the other fellow, especially the Jew, but it is pretty disastrous for yourself. In no time at all, you would be bereft of anything you ever strived and worked for, including your home, your money, your business, and any assets you might ever have had. This is, of course, completely in line again with the concept of being the village idiot, and being poor in spirit, and being meek, as described earlier. A more sensible and more fitting answer to this would be the old saying, "A fool and his money are soon parted." We note again that the idiotic non sequitur argument is used as to why you should do this. Namely, that if you should defend yourself in court, why? The judge might have you thrown in jail so naturally, or is it? You would not defend yourself. In the same chapter 5:29 and 30, this gem of advice is dispensed in the Sermon of the Mount. "If thy right eye offend thee, pluck it out. If thy right hand offend thee, cut it off." Evidently, this means that if your eyes or your hands have caused you to sin, destroy and mutilate those parts of the body. This is the non sequitur argument again raised to its ultimate idiocy. In the first place, neither the eye nor the hand have any particular part in decision-making. If we were to follow this stupid bit of advice, this country would be overrun with hordes of one-eyed, one-armed, helpless nitwits, who would have of their own volition mutilated parts of their body in order to comply with the requirements of this idiotic piece of advice from the Sermon on the Mount. As an indication of how few people really follow any of this kind of utterly impossible advice, I have never seen anyone, nor heard of anyone, that has plucked out their eye or cut off their hand just to make sure that the eye or the hand did not induce them to repeat some alleged sin. To make unswervingly sure that you will not miss the point, and that you will set yourself up like the proverbial sitting duck for the rapacious Jew, in Matthew 5:39, Christ says, "Resist not evil, and turn the other cheek." In a world where nature has put supreme emphasis on survival, and only the fittest survive, this advice is so obviously suicidal that we can hardly mistake its malicious intent. If we understand the English language correctly, this means that any crook, gangster, or criminal who wants to come along and rob you, plunder you, commit mayhem and do you in, why? Be a good Christian chump and let him. Don't fight back. Don't resist. In fact, encourage him. and turned the other cheek in case he missed the fact that you had two cheeks to smash into pulp rather than just one. If we were to follow this kind of suicidal advice, we would do away with all our law enforcement organizations, such as the police force, the sheriff's department, the highway patrol, the FBI, and we would not only let the criminals run rampant, but encourage them by turning the other cheek. We would also do away with our army, navy, and air force, in fact, our whole military establishment, and let, for instance, the Russians, the Chinese, or any other aggressive enemy, or anybody else, run all over us. What idiotic, suicidal advice. This is so completely contrary to all that experience and history has taught us, and completely contrary to all the laws of nature in the animal kingdom. Every animal, every bird, every other species, when threatened with assault, will instinctively defend itself. Even the most timid, such as a rabbit, when cornered, will defend itself. Even the most timid nesting mother bird will do its utmost to defend its nest and its young when in danger by trying to lure away the threat with a feigned broken leg, should danger appear. The pattern of self-destruction continues. In Matthew 5:42, we are told, "Give to him that asketh of thee, and from him that would borrow of thee, turn thou not away." This, of course, is wonderful advice if you want to create a whole nation of freeloaders. Unfortunately, a whole nation of freeloaders can't survive, since freeloaders have to have a substantial group of productive workers upon whom they can freeload. In today's world, where more and more people are holding out their hand and expecting the other man to support them, anybody who would follow this silly advice would soon be depleted of all his resources and would soon find himself among the destitute. Of course, there is nothing novel about today's army of freeloaders. In all periods of history, there have been parasites, leeches, and freeloaders, even in Roman times. And the obvious lesson of history is the more that is given to the freeloaders, the bigger such an army becomes. The easier it is to freeload, the more of the otherwise respectable people who would work for a living would also become leeches. So the whole impact of this kind of philosophy is to tear down the productive, working, creative citizen and breed a generation of parasites. To give to everybody that asks of you, or to lend money to everybody that asks you, is about the most miserable, silly, destructive advice anybody could possibly give you. And of course, nobody would continue practicing this for very long. It would be impossible, because soon such a person would simply be left with nothing to give. As the saying goes, a fool and his money are soon parted, and a person would have to be a fool to give everything away just for the asking. But as this is right in line with the great new teaching as taught by Jesus Christ, this silly advice too is part of the much ballyhooed Sermon on the Mount. The program for our self-destruction continues in Matthew 43, where we are further given this bit of generous advice. "Ye have heard that it hath been said, Thou shalt love thy neighbor and hate thine enemy. But I say unto you, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, do good to them that hate you, and pray for them that despitefully use you and persecute you." Now, dear friends, aren't you just being too sweet in helping your enemies help you commit hari-kari? If some burglars, armed to the teeth with knives and pistols, were to break into your house and assault you and your family, why should you love them and bless them and do them good? While you're loving them, they would be robbing you and assaulting you and your family. But you don't really mind that, do you? Or do you? Most kosher conservatives will profess that they believe in the Sermon on the Mount, and that they also believe in the Constitution of the United States. Before we go into these completely contradictory and untenable positions, let us see what Webster's definition of the word enemy is. Here are some of the things Webster says. Enemy, one that seeks the injury, overthrow, or failure of a person or thing to which he is opposed. Something injurious, harmful, or deadly. There is more, but I think we have sufficiently demarcated that which we are so foolishly told to love and do good. Now, what does the United States Constitution say about treatment of the enemy? It plainly spells it out. Giving aid and comfort to the enemy is treason. It has been regarded as a capital crime. The punishment for treason throughout history has been most severe. It has been death. Until very recently, when the laws of our own protection have been completely dismantled by the treasonous Jews in our midst. Even as late as the 1950s, the Jewish atom spies, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, were dealt the death penalty. Certainly loving your enemies and doing them good would be considered treason as defined in the Constitution itself. It is therefore, of course, ridiculous and contradictory for anyone to claim they believed in the Constitution of the United States, and also in the Christian teachings. Of the two, despite its many flaws, the Constitution on this issue makes 1,000 times more sense than loving your enemies. In fact, throughout the history of white civilization, traitors have been looked upon as being more despised and more contemptible than murderers or any other foul criminal, and rightfully so. When a person is engaged in a life and death struggle and is betrayed by one of its own kind, the consequences can be disastrous and far-reaching. We of the Church of the Creator are putting new emphasis on the punishment of traitors and treason. Whereas we agree with the established historic concept that treason to the country is punishable by death, we regard racial loyalty as a higher virtue than loyalty to the country. We regard a race traitor as a more abominable criminal than any other. We regard treason to the white race as the most contemptible crime any member can commit, and will institute punishment to fit the crime. Let the race traitors of today, traitors betraying the white race with impunity, take heed. The kind of suicidal response is contrary to all the laws of nature, and also completely contrary to all the laws of common sense and past experience. I don't know of anyone who professes Christianity who has the slightest notion or intention of practicing such a stupid piece of advice. This, of course, is again justified by one of these nonsensical non sequitur arguments. And the reasoning could hardly be more thin, to say the least. Christ says you should do these stupid things, that ye may be the children of your Father, which is in heaven, for he maketh his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sendeth the rain on the just and on the unjust. Now, with such a clincher of a convincing argument, aren't you just simply overwhelmed with the logic of it all? In case you aren't, we'll repeat it here. Here is how it goes. It rains on the criminals just like on the good people. For this overwhelming reason, you should, by all means, let the criminals assault you, rob you, plunder you, or whatever it is that they want to do to you, because, and we'll repeat it if you missed it the first time, because it rains on them the same way as it does on the good people. In case you didn't quite follow that argument, it is followed by a real clincher that reinforces it in verse 46, where the great teacher of righteousness says, "For if you love them which love you, what reward have ye? Do not even the publicans do the same?" Here the non sequitur argument is that evidently in no case should you be like the publicans, whoever they are, and who are evidently using good sense. If the publicans, whoever they are, eat 3 meals a day, in no case should you do the same, even if it makes good sense, because you don't want to be like the publicans. If the publicans wear clothes, live in houses, go to work, get married, raise children, why? Don't do any of those things, because you don't want to be like the publicans, whoever they are. In other words, if a publican has enough sense to get in out of the rain, you don't want to get in out of the rain, because you don't want to be like a publican. In case at this point you still have not been persuaded to part with your hard-earned possessions and all the worldly goods that you have accumulated over a lifetime, and neither giving them away nor loaning them appeals to you, you are advised that there is another way that you can get rid of your possessions. In Matthew 19:21, Jesus says, "Go and sell that thou hast, and give to the poor, and thou shalt have treasure in heaven." Certainly we can conclude that all this advice is consistent. It keeps telling you again and again, get rid of everything you have. If you don't want to simply give your possessions away, do it in a more roundabout way. Sell your goods and then give the money away. Of course, you will end up the same as before, with nothing. That's all right, because that way you'll be laying up treasures in heaven. Here we come to another bit of strange, non sequitur reasoning. If it's just a ghastly crime to have possessions and treasures in this world, actually the only world in which man has ever been known to exist, why is it such a beautiful and righteous thing to lay up treasures in the next world? If it's wrong to lay up treasures in this world, surely it must be wrong to lay up treasures for the next world. If it's a good thing to lay up treasures in the next world, then it must be equally good to lay up treasures in this world. Of course, the big trick is that if you get rid of your treasures in this world, the Jew will get them. And he is not the least bit concerned about who has them in the probably non-existent next world. All that he is really concerned with, of course, is laying his grubby hands on your goods as easily as possible in the here and now. We proceed on to Matthew chapter 6. The Sermon on the Mount and the dispensing of bad advice continue merrily on their way, hand in hand unabated. The first 4 verses make much to do with giving alms in secret. Make sure that thine alms may be in secret, and thy Father, which seeth in secret himself, shall reward you openly. In other words, you're only giving alms so that you will get a better payoff, and that you will get a better reward for it one way or another. But you are to do it in secret. This is, of course, completely contrary to what the Jews do. Any time they even pretend to do something charitable, they make sure that it is highly advertised, and that the whole country knows about it. But you, being a Gentile, are supposed to give and give and give, and never, ever get any credit for it. This brings up the whole subject of giving alms, or in other words, giving charity, which is, in itself, a questionable practice. The whole subject of charity in today's world has become a huge, reprehensible racket. So many different ways and means and devious practices have sprung up with charities that today's good, honest, big-hearted citizen, who is not too bright about where his money is going, is being fleeced and robbed and swindled by a band of professionals. Before anyone gives his hard-won money to anyone, he should investigate and make doubly sure just what the money is going to be used for. He should be unequivocally certain it is not going to be actually used to promote those that are hostile to him, that it will not be used to aid people who are completely alien and a threat to his own existence and to that of his own family. We are being continuously asked to send money to help the Korean children, money to buy food packages to be shipped to people in India, money to help the Indians in New Mexico, and who knows where else. We are being robbed of billions in the form of foreign aid, which is being used to promote our communist enemies, to promote the colored races, and in fact to promote and propagate blacks, the colored, and all kinds of people on the face of the earth, who are a threat to our very existence, and would, at their first opportunity, destroy us. We next go through about a dozen verses which make a great deal to do about praying in secret. The reasons are not very clear, except that thy Father, which seeth in secret, shall reward thee openly. We are again looking for rewards that will exceed our investments, which is rather hypocritical and in open contradiction to the admonition of lay not up for yourselves treasures upon earth, where moth and rust doth corrupt, and where thieves break through and steal. We are again being torn two ways. We are continually being told that we must not work for any gains, nor reward, or any profits, or goods, or any of the good things of life here on earth. But then we are told that if we pray in secret and give alms in secret, our Heavenly Father will reward us. In other words, we'll reap some handsome dividends, presumably in the here and now. As far as being rewarded in the hereafter, we may or may not get to this hereafter if there actually is one. Even if there is one, the chances are 1,000 to 1, even according to the rules laid down in the good book, that we will never get to heaven at all, but will end up in eternal hellfire. Therefore, playing all these chances, A, that there is no such a place in the first instance, and B, that the chances are 1,000 to 1 that we won't make it, then it is a rather bad investment to forego all the rewards on this earth and defer them to laying up treasures in heaven. It is rather ridiculous to concentrate on laying up treasures in heaven if chances are extremely remote that you will ever get there in the first place. It certainly does seem strange and contradictory that it's such a good policy to have all these treasures waiting for you in the next life, when there is little or no assurance of getting there. But it's terrible to work for honest rewards for yourself and your family in this life. If it's such a crime to lay up treasures, in other words, accumulate wealth in this world, why is it such a virtue to lay up treasures in the next world? If accumulating wealth is a crime per se, then it certainly must be a crime in the hereafter. In Matthew 6, verse 25, Christ certainly goes all out to destroy any sense of responsibility the good, honest citizen may have acquired for a good upbringing by his parents. He says, "Therefore I say unto you, take no thought for your life, what ye shall eat or what ye shall drink, nor yet for your body, what ye shall put on." And in verse 26, he says, "Behold the fowls of the air, for they sow not, neither do they reap nor gather into barns, yet your heavenly Father feedeth them. Are ye not much better than they?" If we take a good hard look at this piece of suicidal advice, then it is not difficult to understand why the whole Roman civilization fell apart and disintegrated after it embraced Christianity. Here is the most contemptible piece of advice designed to undermine the responsibility that a father might have in providing for his family, or the citizen's responsibility towards his country, or that of the soldier in defending his empire. In fact, it would even prevent you from so much as taking care of your own sustenance and taking care of your own body. The parable about beholding the fowls of the air that sow not nor reap is completely contrary to the facts of life. In the first chapter of this book, we studied about the life cycle of that great bird, the eagle, one of nature's great hunters. We found that the eagle worked hard and consistently in covering his territory of approximately 100 square miles in order to forage for game and food to bring home to his family. Practically most of the bird's waking hours are spent either hunting for food or building a nest and raising its young. And so it goes with practically every bird you observe in nature. It goes out and beats the bushes and scurries around working through most of the day, gathering food for itself and for the offspring in its nest. Squirrels will lay up nuts for the winter. Bees gather honey for the next generation as well as food for its whole colony. Beavers build dams and build houses in order that their group will have shelter and be able to accumulate food for their own survival. Every plant and every flower that grows is in competition with other plants and weeds and forms of life struggling to sink down their roots and gather moisture and food in order that they can grow and produce seed and bring in the next generation. Any species of life that is too sluggish to put forth the most strenuous effort for its own survival in competition with all others is mercilessly phased out by nature. Human beings have the most advanced intellect, are the most responsible, and are the most capable of planning and building a society. To advise them that they should give no thought for tomorrow, nor give any thought for their life, for what they eat, or what they wear, or what they provide for their children, is most fantastic, to say the least. In any case, it is just about the most irresponsible type of advice you could give to anyone. We proceed further to verse 31, where Christ says, "Therefore take no thought, saying, what shall we eat, or what shall we drink? For after all these things do the Gentiles seek." Here Christ again slyly indulges in his non sequitur type of argument and reverts to the silly, insupportable argument that if the publicans do it, we must do it differently. If the Gentiles do these things, it must be wrong. If the Gentiles live in houses, it must be wrong. If the Gentiles work for a living, it must be wrong. If the Gentiles eat 3 meals a day, it must be wrong. If the Gentiles get into their pants 1 leg at a time, you've got to do it differently. Jump in with both legs at the same time. Chapter 6 ends with verse 34, which says, "Take therefore no thought for tomorrow, for tomorrow will take thought for the things of itself." In other words, don't think, don't work, don't plan, don't do anything. Everything will take care of itself. If you can think of any better advice for the destruction of a society, of a country, of a family, and in fact of our race, I certainly don't know what it would be. Contrast this kind of advice with the advice the Jews retain for themselves in the Old Testament, where they admonish, "Where there is no vision, the people perish." Proverbs 29, verse 18. Let us now proceed on to the third chapter of the Sermon on the Mount, namely Matthew chapter 7, which has, right in the first verse, a piece of advice that, if followed, would make a person a candidate for a mental institution. The first verse says, "Judge not that ye be not judged." Now we are all given by a benevolent nature, an intelligence which sets us apart from the rest of the creatures of this world. One of the finest attributes that a man can develop over the years by the use of this intelligence is good, sound judgment. The average, intelligent, normal person uses judgment at least hundreds of times a day, probably thousands of times a day. If he were about to abandon that judgment, he would, in effect, be abandoning his senses. He would be abandoning the good common sense that he was born with, and in fact, negating and destroying all that he had learned over the years, ever since the day he was born. To abandon one's judgment is to abandon one's senses, and is to become, in effect, a hopeless imbecile. Again, in the second verse, we are being subjected to a real clincher of a non sequitur argument to back up why we should not judge, saying that, "For what judgment ye judge, ye shall be judged." The answer is, so what? Of course, we are going to be judged by others, regardless of what we do, and the more idiotic we are in refraining from using our judgment, the more harshly we are going to be judged by others who observe this, and will most certainly exercise their judgment. Anyone knows that, in any case, in order to live at all, in order to meet the responsibilities of life, we certainly not only must use judgment, but we are continually compelled to use our very best possible judgment. In the seventh verse, Christ says, "Ask, and it shall be given unto you." This, of course, is not true. If all a person had to do was ask, and everything was given to him, who would do the work that would create all those things that everyone is asking for? Was this great country in America built by just the asking? Was the winning of the West and the building of ranches, farms, roads, and railroads accomplished by just the asking, or was it accomplished by strenuous hard work and sacrifice? This theory and philosophy is completely in contradiction to all the good experience of history, and only a shiftless idiot could accept it as an excuse for getting out of earning an honest living. Of course, this is exactly in line with the suicidal philosophy that the Jewish-controlled welfare government is pursuing in America today. It is continually telling the shifty, the freeloaders, the lazy, the blacks, the niggers, those who will not work, that all they have to do is apply for relief, apply for welfare, pretend that they are destitute, pretend that they can't work. In fact, just about any pretext will do. raise large numbers of illegitimates, and the government will come to the rescue with money and welfare, with food and clothing, shelter and all the other goodies. Now the government doesn't really produce any of these things. What it does is rob and steal these by force from the creative, responsible, productive citizens that do produce and do work. It takes these from the productive elements by force of law and threat of reprisals. The government punishes the productive citizens and rewards the shiftless and the freeloaders. This is, of course, exactly in line with Jesus' teachings. Ask and it shall be given. Think not of tomorrow, for tomorrow will take care of itself, and all the other destructive advice that is so highly lauded in the Sermon on the Mount. So far I have only basically quoted from the Sermon on the Mount, and a few other dovetailing adjuncts, and we have come up with a persistent pattern of nothing but real, bad, suicidal, destructive advice. Most of the Sermon on the Mount is contained in Matthew chapters 5, 6, and 7. However, the same bad advice is repeated again in Mark, and also in Luke, and also in John, and then further amplified throughout the rest of the New Testament. I believe that the evidence by now is overwhelmingly clear that the whole intent was at the time of the Romans and is today to give the white man such bad advice that if he even halfway tried to follow it, he would destroy himself and tear apart the fabric of his society. I could go on and further pile evidence upon evidence, but I believe the point has been made, and to proceed further would be just a matter of overkill. Having examined it in the light of cold reason, it is hard to understand why anyone would place so much value on such a collection of trash, or why they would buy such a bag of garbage. Nevertheless, it should prove to us how effectively a well-laid plan of propaganda and brain pollution can work if applied skillfully and persistently. The fact is that the Jews did apply their deception skillfully and persistently, and they did sell it to the Romans. By the 4th century AD, the Romans were engulfed by it and destroyed by it. The white race thereafter was plunged into 1,000 years of the Dark Ages. Now that we have properly analyzed what the inherent poison of Christianity is, we can easily understand why. In summation, Christianity is a teaching designed to confuse, divide, and destroy the white race by not only tearing apart the fabric of society itself, but by also setting an individual at odds with himself by destroying the natural instincts given to him by nature for his own self-preservation. Let us pursue this last indictment further. How does it tear the individual apart? We have already noted that the Christian teachings, if they are believed and practiced, dull and stifle all the good instincts that nature gave us for our own self-preservation, thereby leaving us frustrated and torn apart. We are told that all those things that we would naturally do are bad, and we must follow these new artificial teachings that are completely contrary to the laws of nature. We are told to do this in order to gain salvation. Here is the crux of the thing. Either you believe and follow the idiotic, self-destructive, suicidal advice, or you are doomed to eternal hellfire. You are naturally born bad, we are told. All those fine instincts nature gave you are bad. So the argument goes. And therefore, along comes Christ to save you from your wicked natural desires, and to save you from going to hell. This is called salvation. Before the New Testament was written, and before Christianity appeared on the scene to plague the Romans in particular, and the white race in general, the good people of Rome were not aware that their souls were in jeopardy of being damned to hell. They had never heard of hell. They were not particularly concerned with the multitude of problems they might have in a hereafter, which to them was, after all, more or less just a dim fairy tale. The Romans were good, industrious, law-abiding people. They had enough real problems to cope with that were with them in the here and now, and they took care of them rather well. They built a network of roads throughout Italy and much of Europe. They built aqueducts and cities. They brought law and order to the uncivilized tribes of Western Europe. At the height of the glory that was Rome and the splendor that was Greece, Christianity hit the Roman citizens like a plague, and Rome began to crumble. As Christianity spread, the obsession with saving their souls became the main preoccupation of these new converts. Instead of taking care of their duties in the here and now, the only real world that has ever been known, their minds became unhinged and were increasingly preoccupied with what would happen to them in the hereafter, a place no one had ever been, no one had ever come back from, and no one really had the slightest inkling of its existence. Despite the fact that there was not the slightest proof of any hereafter, this became the overwhelming obsession of the Romans, to the detriment of their responsibilities and duties to their families, to their country, and to their race. The idea that they needed salvation, which up to that time nobody was particularly aware of or concerned about, is very similar to the Chicago gangsters coming around to different store owners and selling them on the need for protection. Until the gangsters came around and told them that they needed protection, or else their store windows would most surely be smashed by flying objects, the store owners were totally unaware of any need for protection. But the gangsters selling their protection presented it to them as a threat, that either they pay them extortion money or their store windows would be broken. And the threat was only thinly veiled. The selling of salvation is very similar. If you don't buy salvation, the threat is that you will go to hell and burn forever and ever. As I have said before, the very word hell sums up the most depraved, vicious, horrible, vengeful idea that only the very depths of the collective depraved Jewish mind could conjure. On the other hand, in contrast to hell, the image of heaven was dreamed up as the very epitome of bliss and eternal happiness. By using the carrot and the stick method to the most ultimate extremes the human imagination could conceive, with these psychological weapons, they deceived, bludgeoned, and euchred the white people of Rome into destroying themselves. Thank you.